It's the Trupany Show with your host, James Trupany.
Hello and welcome to the Trupany Show. My name is James Trupany and this is my show. And today we are back with the Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling in Japan. I believe it is episode number 22. And today we are continuing with our look at 1992. And we're looking back at New Japan Pro Wrestling for the third time in this chapter, looking at the history of cards in professional wrestling in Japan. We're looking at Super Show, the WCW and New Japan Pro Wrestling Super Show crossover, or Starrcade in the Tokyo Dome, as it was known to Japanese fans. And to join me today is the wonderful Miss Chelsea Spolin of ShouldersUp.net. How are you, Mom?
I'm doing okay. I feel very fancy being wonderful this time around, so that's nice.
I thought it was a good descriptive word.
Well, thank you.
That's okay. We're looking at this show, which was 1992, and really, New Japan Pro Wrestling was deep set in its crossover deal with WCW, which you would float back and forth on over the next coming years, but clearly Eric Bischoff had done a lot of work to cement this relationship and make it well worthwhile as far as WCW were concerned, as far as international exposure, and as far as New Japan Pro Wrestling were concerned, as far as big houses were. This was the Tokyo Dome at its most Tokyo Dome, a sellout show. Now, these numbers are probably papered, and I think it was 64,500 people in the building. That doesn't necessarily mean there was all ticket buyers, though. We're probably looking at around 55,000 paying customers, which is an awful lot for one wrestling show. And there was a lot of...
I was going to say, that's still a lot.
Yeah. It's not like what you get now at the Tokyo Dome, where you probably get 40,000 in the building and about 25,000 of them are paid. So, yeah, it's a lot better then than it was now. And it was a really cracking card on paper. Not necessarily a great card itself. Chelsea, what was your overall view of this particular wrestling show?
A lot of this is well-intentioned, but feels like kind of a disaster.
That's a good way of putting it. That was kind of what I was looking at as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of very awkward stuff on this card, and there are some matches where I just don't, I don't know what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, it is. It's difficult to explain what was going on a lot of the time in this card. But we'll start with the opening match, which was the late departed Black Cat. He defeated Hiroshi Yamamoto in 10 minutes and 28 seconds. A basic junior heavyweight opener, really. You kind of get these things now with the young boys in the dojo coming out and doing this stuff. And it was basically what you'd see there, really. Nothing spectacular, though the fans were really behind Yamamoto. It was a dark match as well. It didn't appear on the WCW pay-per-view. What did you think of this one, Chelsea?
Well, when I realized that Yamamoto was Tenzan, I was much more interested. I mean, like, it feels kind of like a basic Young Lion match. Like, it's not too different from some of the matches that the Young Lions get today when they start to make their ascension from the Young Lion, like, rookies with no name to a position of, you know, like, oh, we know who that guy is on the card. It's very weird seeing Tenzan, like, as a scrawny rookie. Because I'm used to him being, like, a total badass who is, like, you know, an old-school guy who has these amazing, like, 4- or 5-star matches with dudes that people talk about for days after. But, I mean, this is, like, it's a very basic match. It's simple. It's actually, I think, a little bit better than some of the stuff that follows.
Yeah, I think so as well. You know, it was well put together and simple, and sometimes if you don't push the boundaries, you can get it right much better. You know, it's a lot easier to deal with. And this was a good example of that. You know, Yamamoto, or Hiroshi Tenzan as we know him today, in purple tights and purple shoot shoes as well, which is a big departure from what we know him as now. And he clearly hasn't filled out, but he's well on the way to that big muscular frame that he has. And the head's the right size, obviously, but no frosted tips. He hasn't reached full Tenzan yet.
I didn't recognize him at first. It was only when I was looking on Cage Match after I looked at the whole card that I was like, wait a minute here. I know who that guy is.
Yeah, that's it. He was Hiroshi Tenzan, the Raging Bull himself. And yeah, you know, after this he goes off to Europe and CWA and has his learning excursion. This was really him getting started. But it shows you this exposure at a big level from a young age did those wrestlers no end of good.
Yeah.
You know, I was at my dad's house on Thursday, actually, and he had an old New Japan tape that he'd just stuck in. He'd found. He hadn't watched it in ages. And it was Tony Holm versus Big Van Vader. And as they walked to the ring, I noticed Satoshi Kojima with his head down at ringside. Because he was a young boy then.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pre-Bread Club days.
Oh, well before the Bread Club was even thought of. Yeah, it was just this Kojima just like sticking down. He'd got his head down. He was accompanying Tony Holm to the ringside. He was being a young boy, as young boys did. And it was like...
He probably loved bread even then.
You know, we can say that, yeah. I'm sure he did. Okay, then the second match. Isumi Kudo and Kunaki Kobayashi defeated Kengo Kimura and Kantoro Hoshino. It was a tag match, 11 minutes and 54 seconds. And it was all right. I mean, me and Alex, when we did the first Starrcade at the Tokyo Dome last month or a month or two ago, we mentioned Kido then was at the end of his career and, you know, he was giving it the old college try. And this is another example of that. He's still there. He's a guy getting the youngsters over, giving them someone to work and developing this younger talent. And that's what it does with this match. And noticeably, as we go through this card, all these matches are roughly the same length with some notable examples. They're all 10 to 15 minutes long, which is interesting. But yes, it was all right. It did what it said on the tin. Nothing spectacular. Your thoughts, Chelsea?
So this is standard fare. It's, you know, it's pretty good. Like, it seems like at least everybody in this match is really trying. Like, everybody in this match is invested in making sure that it is a good match. And I can't say that about every match on this card. I thought, you know, it kind of seems like Kido is not just, like, past his prime, but, like, I felt a little bad for him. Like, when he goes to do the arm bar to, I think it's Hoshino, he clearly has some trouble. And, like, I just, you know, I could tell he was really trying, but that he wasn't able to do the things that he could have done probably when he was at his athletic peak when he was a bit younger.
Yeah.
It's not a bad match, but I think it's intended as just like, you know, this is an enjoyable filler.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, really. You know, get some people over. And it wasn't on the main card as far as WCW is concerned, because no one know who any of these people are. So,
yeah.
But in the next match, they did know who people were. Jushin Thunder Liger, Masahashi Aoyagi, and Akira Nagami defeated the Outlaws, Hiro Saito, Super Strong Machine, and Norio Hanaga in 15 minutes and 12 seconds in a thoroughly enjoyable match with lots of action, lots of heel stuff from the Outlaws. But again, we talked about that with Alex. The Outlaws were kind of like a junior heavyweight equivalent of Suzuki Gun today. Super Strong Machine had turned heel to support them or be their leader. And this had some strong character work in it. And Jushin Thunder Liger is just on his way to superstardom, and it's written all over him in this match. What did you think of this one, Chelsea?
Mostly my favorite thing about this match is Liger. Like, you know, the purple outfit and just, like, he's so charismatic. Like, I don't even know how else to describe it. It's really interesting to me that Liger manages in basically, like, every era of his career to be somebody that catches your attention. I just don't even know how he does it. This is not a bad match, but it kind of, given like some of the stuff that all of the guys in this match are capable of, it did feel a little like, I would have rather maybe that they picked two of these guys and had them have a single match, you know, like Liger and Akira or Liger and Aoyagi or like even like Liger and Super Strong Machine, you know, like really, I guess I just want Liger to have a singles match instead of this tag match. I think that's my true heart's desire.
Yeah, I can see that, you know. Again, I watched the when I was watching it with my dad, I was watching Liger versus Ultima Dragon from the next year's Super Show, because that was on the tape as well.
And that sounds like fun.
And my dad was going, you're going to be late for work. And I was like, I'll be fine. No, you're going to be late for work. I'll take it out. Next time you're over, we can watch the rest of the match. And it's like taped off Eurosport 25 years ago, and it was just like, and I've seen it before a million times, it's such a classic, but it's like, Ligo just has that, he draws you into you, you want to see what he's going to do. He has that,
yeah.
He has so much X factor about him as a pro wrestler, and it was so much fun to watch him in that environment again, you know, because we see him today as kind of like that mid-card gatekeeper, he's the guy you have
right.
to go through to get to the champion. And
right.
he's, you know, he's not what he once was, but he's still stunning and he's still a spectacle to see Eno, and it, you know, of all the guys I haven't seen in pro wrestling, he's one I'd really like to see before he retires, just because of who he is. And this was all right. I kind of liked it. Ayu Yagi, who's is an interesting character as an MMA guy trying to cross over into pro wrestling, but he had a lot of fire to him and a lot of charisma, I thought, as well. I enjoy his work too.
Yeah, I mean, he's not bad at all. Like, nobody in that match is bad or does anything bad. It's meant to be like a fluffy filler match, and that's kind of what it is.
Yeah. Okay, then we moved on to match four, which was the Enforcers, Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko. They defeated Miyoshi Ohara and Shiro Koshinaka in 12 minutes and 32 seconds. And I was watching this match, and I was like, by God, I miss Larry Zbysko.
He's certainly unique.
I just love his ability to have, this match was 12 minutes, and he barely did anything for 7 of them. You know, but it was interesting. It was a fascinating guy to watch. He was recently on Art of Wrestling, and he kind of explained his philosophy of, like, you know, he wanted the matches to be entertaining, and he wanted people to really hate him. So he did all he could to make people really hate him. And, you know, he was like, you know, I can have an hour match and I don't actually have to touch the guy for the first 20 minutes. Let's pace ourselves here. So, yeah, I really, really enjoyed this match just because I missed the Enforcers. They were a tag team that were at the right place at the right time in WCW. Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko were great as a tag team together. And they did such a good job together, and they kind of held the tag team division together when the Steiner brothers left WCW. So I was always a big fan of the Enforcers, even though I'm not supposed to be really because of their heels, but they did everything right for me to make the match work. And they kind of had the right opponents in Koshinaka and Ohara here. 12 minutes and 32 seconds. A fun, entertaining match, which really showcased what WCW was about more than what New Japan was about.
This is definitely, like you were just saying, more of the American style than the Japanese style. Which is okay, you know. I think actually it kind of seemed like maybe the crowd was a little more interested.
Yeah.
Because of it, because probably just like it wasn't something they saw all the time, you know, like a lot of the Tokyo Dome crowd, maybe they didn't pay attention to WCW, or I don't know if WCW was even on TV regularly back then for them. Was it? Do you know?
I think they probably put highlight packages on on New Japan shows to give the Japanese fans a chance to see, and certainly the big names. Well, Larry Zbysko was a big name in Japan because he defended the AWA title at Battlefield a couple of years before in 1990, which is the first Tokyo Dome show, and he headlined it. So he was well known. Arn Anderson, not so much, but he had spent time in Japan through the Royal Japan deal. So I guess those two were known there, but they wouldn't be super, super known like, say, Flair or Hogan or people like that.
Right. That makes sense. The best part of this match for me was actually seeing Arn Anderson because he's so good in matches like this, and most of the work that I've seen from him was kind of like after his prime. And you know, he's one of those guys that like wrestling guys now always talk about. Like they talk about his influence, and they talk about having learned from him, and they talk about him as a producer. So it was kind of cool getting to see him in action. I also thought that which is his name? Ohara, the guy who has clearly like some martial arts experience.
Yeah.
I thought the fact that he clearly wasn't used to being like a wrestler, he wasn't used to professional wrestling, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Because some of the moves he does, he really goes for it. And he goes for it, and I mean, he's not trying to hurt his opponent, but he goes for it more than most professional wrestlers do because they're trying so hard not to hurt their opponent, you know? Like, he hasn't quite figured out how to straddle that line of, like, making it look like a fight and having it actually be a fight. So that was actually really interesting to me.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It was such a nice change to see a kind of, because I don't watch much American wrestling anymore, an American-style tag match in this environment was really interesting for me to watch, especially when it's the Enforcers who are just really, really good at that style of wrestling.
Yeah, you know, they are.
You can watch anything that's interesting. When I was around about this time, I was listening to a radio show that used to be on the Sky Satellite Network, on Sky Movies, I think it was, or one of the channels, and they used to have a wrestling radio show. And when WCW toured the UK, I think it was in 1993, they had a competition. Was if you see a sign in we want to put signs in the crowd, the best sign wins this prize. And the sign had to say, Arn Anderson is God.
Ha! Huh.
And the winner of that competition was, because they were backstage doing press, and Barry Windham came backstage and went, do you see that sign out there? It said Arn Anderson is God. And those are the ones who won the prize.
Nice.
Yes. It was really, really cool. So we'll move on to match five, which is kind of a sad one given the recent anniversary of his passing. Dusty Rhodes making perhaps his last shot in Japan, tagging with his son Dustin in a match against Masa Saito and Kim Duk. 14 minutes and 23 seconds. The fans still love Big Dust in Japan. He was over like Rover. Dustin not so much, but as you could expect, he wasn't really new to the audience. This was one of the only tag matches in Dustin and Dusty had together in this time period in WCW. They tagged later on in WCW, but this was fun to watch, and it was good to see Dusty again. I haven't watched any of his matches in a while. And he was doing his groove thing. It was really, really cool. I enjoyed this match a lot. Masa Saito and Kim Duk were probably the best opponents for them to have in that old, slower, traditional, strong style approach that they had. So it matched up with what Dusty was used to from Japan in the 1970s and 1980s. So it kind of gelled well for me, though it wasn't like the most exciting thing on the planet, but it was kind of a nostalgia trip. What did you think, Chelsea?
It was a trip for me to see Gold Dust, not as Gold Dust, I've never watched him wrestle outside of that gimmick before. That was really interesting.
He's so green
in this match. Like, holy crap.
Well, he'd had some time in Florida Championship Wrestling, which was run by his dad. And he'd had some time in Memphis as well, I think. Yeah, I was really interested to see what you thought of Dustin Rhodes as opposed to Goldust, because it kind of clicked me when watching. Like, Chelsea may never have seen Dustin Runnels wrestle as Dustin Rhodes.
I never had. It was really cool. He reminded me a little bit of Cody when Cody was really green. He's bursting with enthusiasm in this match. And it's interesting because everybody else, it's like, you know, it's another day at the office. So there, everybody else is like pretty chill. And he has no chill in this match. He's just like, he wants it to be good so badly. And it was interesting also, I guess, seeing a little of the dynamic with him and Dusty, because I know that later on in their relationship, things got really contentious, and then it took a long time for them to patch things up. But it seemed like in this period, like, they had a pretty good relationship. It's interesting to me to see Dustin working so hard to try to get himself over, when I feel like a big part of what makes Gold Dust really interesting is that he doesn't try too hard. He just does things and you react to them, you know?
Yeah, I think that probably had a lot to do with the Dustin Rhodes character being far too close to the Dusty Rhodes character.
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, I loved Dustin Runnels in this particular time period because he was trying so hard. The tag team he had with Barry Windham were off the page good, you know, and he did some incredible matches, solo matches. His single matches with Steve Austin still stand up today as some of the best wrestling I've seen out of WCW in that time period. They were just really good because they were young and hungry. They didn't quite know what they were doing yet, and they were trying everything to get over. And Austin was an absolute bump machine in that time period. You know, but Austin in that time period was having man of the matches in six-man Thunderdome cage matches where all he did was bump all night. But people were watching him for the bumps. He was that good, you know. This was a nice trip down, brought me back to WCW memory lane in 1992 for sure. And Saito and Kim Duk were no passengers. They had a good run in this match. Saito especially, because he's always a captivating kind of guy to watch. You can see why he was a main event kind of guy for such a long time in New Japan Pro Wrestling as well.
Yeah.
Then we have a run of matches which are, well, this is where the wheels come off, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll start with six, which was a dark match. Thank Christ, because I wouldn't put this on television anywhere. Tony Holm versus Scott Norton. Now, this is interesting because a year before, Scott Norton had demolished the Equalizer in a bloody awful match, as me and Alex Watt described it in the last time we looked at Tokyo in New Japan in the Tokyo Dome. And this year, time around, he gets Tony Holm, the big Finnish guy who WWF fans of the mid-90s would know as Ludwig Borger. That's the way WWF pronounced it, so I'm going to try the same thing.
Now,
Tony Holm was a retired boxer, and he was one of New Japan's discoveries. And as a heavyweight, he wasn't that bad. But he's one of those guys you want in small doses. And this was far too long.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the things I did notice was that I think Scott was a bit pissed with this match because he was belting Tony Holmes, something chronic. And Scott was rough on everybody in this time period. Like when he made his debut in New Japan Pro Wrestling, I can't remember who he was tagging with. I think he was tagging with a couple of another American guys. But they, like, everyone had told him, you've got to like make a great first impression. And he just demolished Tatsumi Fujinami and Antonio Inoki in the first 2 minutes. And like his American partner's like, calm down. So him taking on Tony Halm, this was going to be irresistible force and immovable objects. And it was. And Tony Holm's actually not that bad. And Scott Norton's very good. It's just that it just doesn't fit right because you've got two guys who do a similar thing doing a similar thing to each other. When it's against somebody else, it's really quite interesting. When it's together, not so much. But I did like Scott Norton in this match despite the fact he lost.
This is 8 minutes that I had a hard time sitting through because I mean they hit each other a whole bunch and there wasn't really any discernible story. It was just I was really bored.
Fair enough. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see because this is the kind of match that gets Scott Norton a bad reputation, but it's not his fault, if you see what I mean. He's like, he's trying really hard, but the person he's working with cannot possibly do the things he wants him to do. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the kind of match that Ben Spindler hates because it's got Scott Norton in it.
Nah.
But yeah, so we'll move on to match 7. Which was a bit more interesting. Shinya Hashimoto against Bill Kazmaier. Did you know who Bill Kazmaier was before you watched this, Chelsea?
No.
Bill Kazmaier I knew long before his time in WCW because he's a 4-time World Strongest Man and is arguably the greatest strongman who ever lived. He's the most successful person in that sport.
Really? That's amazing.
And he was a big star in Europe because every Christmas we used to have World Strongest Man on the BBC and in similar European stations around. So he was a big name before he got to WCW, but strongman competitions in America don't really attract that much media attention, so he wasn't that big a name, but that's where they hung his gimmick around. At this particular point, he was green as freshly mown grass on a wet day.
Yeah.
So why in God's name would you stick him in with the destroyer Shinya Hashimoto? Don't really
this
make...
This is so awkward.
Yeah, I mean, like, Kazmaier's a big guy, and he's pretty tough. But it's quite honestly clear that Hashimoto could just kill him in less than 30 seconds, given the opportunity. And given the look on Hashimoto's face, I think he wanted to.
Oh, he totally did. Yeah. No, he was plotting some murder.
Hashimoto is not getting what he wants from Bill at the time. And Bill's trying, bless him, but he just hasn't got the skill set to compete with one of the greatest wrestlers who ever lived. Which means that the 8 minutes and 37 seconds this match lasts is probably about 7 minutes too long. What did you think of it, Chelsea?
This match is really bad booking. Like, I felt really bad for both of those guys. Both of those guys felt really bad for themselves. It's super awkward and terrible.
It is. There's no other way to describe it. It's not as bad as the Equalizer match on Starrcade 91, which was just dreadful in everything. Badly executed, you know, it just doesn't work. This doesn't work in a whole different way. Like, Kazmaier should have been shoved in the opening 6-man that no one was going to watch so he could grow and learn and wrestle some people he knew what they were doing. And Hashimoto should have had a match with, let's see. Well, anyone.
Really, almost anything else.
Yeah, you see, if you'd stuck Hashimoto and Scott Norton together, that had been worth something to see. And to be honest, it headlined the biggest card of all time 3 years later. So it wasn't, it wasn't a bad match to see, let's be honest. But in this particular case, it just doesn't work. And Bill is out of his depth by a long, long, long way. It doesn't help that the next match is Big Van Vader versus El Gigante. Now, El Gigante, well, we talked about him on the last Starrcade as well because he wrestled Big Cat Hughes in a match that wasn't actually that bad because it did what it was said it was supposed to do. Now, Gigante had a year to get better, and he really hadn't got better, but how are you going to teach a guy that size anything really that much? He's just a big dude. He was better at wrestling generally than he was the year before, and arguably, Big Van Vader, a rounded veteran, was probably the best guy to stick him with. This wasn't as bad as the previous two matches, believe it or not, and this is the second time El Gigante ended up on a card where he wasn't the worst in the worst wrestling match on the show. and I can't remember that ever happening before. Did you know of anything of El Gigante maybe as Giant Gonzalez in WWF and that terrible feud he had with The Undertaker?
I think I saw maybe one or two of his matches, but they were not memorable to me. They were pretty bad.
Yeah, they're just dreadful. What did you think of this match?
This is really bad. I try not to say that, you know, I try to find something positive to say about everybody, but that's just not possible. This is not a good matchup. Like, Vader, my impression of Vader is that he kind of, even for being a guy who was spectacularly mobile for his size at his peak, he kind of needs a guy who's smaller than him to work with. His style doesn't really work that well when he's got a guy that's bigger than him. And El Gigante, he just doesn't know what he's doing. Like, he does a brain claw in this match that's just really embarrassing. And I was kind of, like, at one point I was just kind of like, maybe they'll just start hitting each other and that would be better. And they didn't. They tried, but it was, maybe they didn't try. I don't know. I can't even tell if they're trying. This is really bad. Like, I think this is the worst thing on this card.
We also get into the point of the squib finishes with this as well. Like, the match ends when they brawl to the outside of the ring and Vader puts El Gigante's head over his mask and the steam comes out the mask, which is like the least New Japan Pro Wrestling finish ever. And it is there clearly to protect these two because they want them on the biggest show in the US where they'll actually make some money with them. And it's like protecting both of them, but it kind of sets up a storyline which never got paid off because it's WCW and everyone forgot.
Yep.
So it's just not, it just doesn't click. You know, similarly, and the Phoebe's talking about, on that show I was watching with my dad, like I said, it was Big Van Vader from Shinya versus Tony Holm about 6 months later. And that was pretty good for what it was because Tony Holm's a bit smaller. He was fighting from underneath and he snuck out a victory. Using a wrestling hold in that match, believe it or not. So, you know, it was like they just jigged this round the wrong way round, and it would have been made so much more sense if Tony Holm was the guy to face Vader, and maybe El Gigante was off in that six-man tag match with Bill Kazmaier.
I mean, yeah, it's really bad, and I don't know who booked this or why they booked it, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah, they should. Damn it.
it feels mean to say that, but like it's true. It's just not good.
Okay, then we move on then to match 9, which was another dark match, which I find this interesting because of all the people on this card, American fans are going to know. Surely Antonio Inoki is going to be one of them.
You would think.
And they'd all watched that classic with Kensuke Sasaki and Hiroshi Hase the previous year against the Steiner brothers, so surely they should know him too.
You would think.
So they put this as a dark match. Okay, 10 minutes and 9 seconds. This was kind of a master versus student match. That was kind of the story of the match. And it's very shoot strong styly orientated with Hase and Inoki trying to avoid using the ropes. They do run the ropes a little bit, but it is very much down on the ground. And of course, the fans are absolutely stoic behind Inoki. He could do no wrong in this time period. He'd brought himself down the card rather sensibly and were letting other people shine. But he was still a big draw for the company and still had a big impact on the company. 10 minutes and 9 seconds is a little short given the technical wizardry of the two people involved. However, I don't think it outstayed its welcome and it didn't outshine anything else on the card. Mainly because other stuff on the card was kind of disappointing, but we'll get to that in a bit. This was well worthwhile though for what it was. It kind of showed Inoki at the end of his career. I'm not so happy that he didn't lose. You know, he probably should have lost to someone like Hase who was going on his way up the card. But it was certainly an interesting matchup and a certain interesting story that was told, though it was a little bit disjointed with the clash of the modern and the old.
So this is a lot better than the previous match.
It had to be.
there's no way it couldn't be. It's a little bit of an Inoki ego fest. And I understand that because Inoki was like, you know, one of the biggest stars that they had and one of the biggest stars of all time in Japan. And I totally get that. I felt personally for me, like what I wanted to see was a match that was trying to tell a little bit more of an even handed story, but it's Antonio Inoki. Like you kind of can't do that. Anybody you put him in the ring with unless they're of an equal level of star power, and that's not very many people, it's just going to be like, oh, it's that guy with Antonio Inoki. The technical stuff in this match is refreshing at this point in the card. Like, you know, both these guys know what they're doing, and that was very, very nice. But at the same time, I also kind of felt like I didn't really see the point of it, you know? Like, I think it would have been better either to have Hiroshi Hase in a match with somebody who was, like, a little closer to his, not his skill level, but his standing in the company, you know? Like, put him with another guy who he has something to either gain or lose something from. Or, you know, put Inoki in a big match with a guy where it's important and there's, like, weight, you know, associated with it, emotional weight. It's not a bad match, like, it's a good match, but it just doesn't really serve a whole lot of purpose in terms of this card that they've put together, other than just being like, it happened, it was nice.
Yeah, it was nice. It was alright. It was good from, like, a drawing power point of view, which is what they were trying to do, I guess. But it told a nice story. But again, it wasn't. There's nothing on this card so far that's really shook our trees down to the ground of, wow, that was really good, except possibly the Enforcers versus Saito and Duck. And even then we said, it's nuts and bolts good mid-card wrestling. It's not, like, the thing you came to see.
Right.
Which kind of makes us worry, because we've only got 3 matches left.
Yikes.
And the next one is Lex Luger versus Masahiro Chono. The future Mr. August, who was well on his way up to being a mainstay of the company at this point. It's 15 minutes and 9 seconds. And to be honest, Chono does drag a good match out of Lex Luger, which is no easy task, as hours of WCW television tapings will attest to. Especially in this period, because this was the period where Luger was working. He was WCW World Champion. He'd won the belt and then pointed out to he only had a certain number of dates left. So he was only going to wrestle those dates and not turn up for the rest of the stuff. So he was off television. He wasn't being particularly nice to work with. He was world's heavyweight champion, and he could pretty much do what he liked. And I think, you know, Chono did an awfully good job here, but it's still not a great match, and probably not worthy the world championship level it was supposed to be. But Masahiro Chono at the time, you know, one of the coolest guys that ever lived, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. No, he just radiates coolness and badassery.
Yeah, he's got everything going for him in this match, except an opponent that's willing to work with anyone.
Yep.
What did you think, Chelsea?
I only have one thing to say about this, and that is that I'm going to block anybody on Twitter who ever makes a Roman Reigns-Lex Luger comparison ever again. Like, it's done, guys. You can't make that comparison anymore. Watch this match and tell me that there's any resemblance between the way those guys, I mean, like, just there's no, Luger doesn't even have the work ethic to bump correctly in this match, okay? Like, it's just, I had to get on my soapbox about that, I'm sorry. it's awful. It's really, really bad. And, like, Chono is so cool, and that's the only thing that saves this match. And Luger is just unwatchable. He's terrible. I get that people like to find analogies for botched pushes in wrestling, and that Luger is a good example of that, but Luger doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, he genuinely didn't care about pro wrestling. I think he actually cares more about pro wrestling now than he ever did when he was a wrestler.
I think so, too.
You know,
yeah, I think he looks back on those days as, like, his glory days, and he appreciates them for what they were. And I think he's also probably realized that he doesn't have that many friends in the wrestling business because of the way he acted.
Yeah, I mean, you look back at Shikara did a few years ago, did a storyline with Green Ant, and it was a parody of the Lex Express, basically. And they shot it in the same way, and they went to the same places, because he was fighting, I think it was Taurus, this big giant of a dude that he was trying to body slam and he couldn't do it. And apparently he'd had a motorcycle accident and he had a plate in his forearm, much the same as someone else we know. And at the end of the series, Lex Luger comes on screen and gives his support to Green Ant and tells him to keep going, buddy, you've got this, I went down this journey as well. And it's like, the Lex Luger of old would never go to what we know is a big-ish, but still not massive, indie company, and shoot a promo for them just because they asked. Because I guarantee
there's no way he got paid a lot of money to do that.
Yeah, if he got paid at all, he only did it because it's a cool thing to do, and fans might see me differently now, and it's something I want to do because they're doing a cool thing, you know. And the Lex Luger of this period would have taken himself far too seriously to have ever done anything like that. He had no sense of humor. You only have to watch the World Bodybuilding Federation TV shows at the same time where he's the comedy heel relief on screen. So, you know, it's like he's, yeah, he's just not good in this match, and it's not good. Interestingly, the title was presented by Bill Hurd in one of the last actions he had as chairman of vice president of WCW, thank God. And this was just one of those things. And he was a guy as well. Luger was put in that position when he really shouldn't have been. He wasn't ready for a title run. Arguably never was ready for a title run. And
if you got a guy who's not ready for it, you should at least pick a guy who cares.
Well, Flair wanted to give the belt to Barry Windham. He said, "I'll drop it to Barry whenever you want. You tell me, I'll be there. I'll give him a classic match and I'll put him over."
Right.
And they said, "No, we want to put it on Luger."
Which I don't, was that, what was that?
Well, the story, while Flair was leaving the company, he'd got out of, his contract come to an end. He talked to Vince. Vince had signed him to go to the WWF. He'd informed Jim Hurd, "This is what's going to happen. I don't mind who you put the title on, but I'd prefer it if it was Barry. If you put it on Barry, I'll be there. Come hell or high water, that's fine. But I don't really want to put it on anyone else because I don't think they're ready for it, and it's not good for you as a company." That was Flair's advice to him. And it's like, you know, Flair didn't have to do that in one sense. You can say a lot of things about Ric Flair, but he did care about WCW and his friends who were trying to make a living. He didn't just leave them in the lurch, you know. And he, this is my advice. And if they wanted on Luger, that's fine. But, you know, when Rick pointed out, "Look, you still owe me $25,000 from back in the day," because back in the day, the NWA champion had to put down a $25,000 deposit on the championship belt, and they would get it back at the end of their title run. Well, Flair and Dusty never bothered to claim back their deposits because they knew they'd get the title back eventually.
Right.
So, you know, you owe me $25,000 for this plus interest for the title belt. And that's the reason why him and Hurd had a falling out. And they decided in the end it was going to be Lex Luger. And Luger and Windham had that cage match, and that was where Luger got the championship. But it didn't fit with the narrative of WCW at the time. They had to turn Luger heel to make it work. Was it worth it? Especially as he then went and informed them, "Well, I'm not coming back to TV for God knows how long, and I'm going to work my contract out because I'm going somewhere else."
Yep.
It was just a disaster, and this match is probably as big a syndrome. And Masahiro Chono deserves more. He was just one of the best wrestlers in the world at this time. He's young, he's full of fire, he's got vigor, he knows what he's doing, and he knows how to make this match work. It was the ideal situation for him to make a big name for himself, and it just didn't happen.
He was a guest commentator on a Joshi event I watched yesterday, and I don't even remember which one because I watched so much wrestling yesterday, but the female wrestlers who are, like, you know, all in their 20s are, like, just, they're just, like, so excited to be in the same space as Masahiro Chono. Like, whenever they get near him, they're like, "Oh my god, he's so great!" Like, you can tell. It's really funny.
Interesting story from talking to Jazzy Gabbert. Jazzy Gabbert is really close friends with the Chono family, and it's like that wherever he goes in Japan.
That's kind of awesome. He deserves it, man.
Yeah, there you go. Mr. August himself. We'll always have friends at the Troopany Show. Right then, number 11 was Riki Chosu versus Tatsumi Fujinami for the Greatest 18 and IWGP Heavyweight Championships, a unification match, which was 12 minutes, 11 seconds, arguably the best thing on the card, and of course, WCW didn't put it on the pay-per-view. Brilliant!
Yeah!
You morons! Right, this was really, really good. I really enjoyed this, because it's Riki Chosu and Tatsumi Fujinami. How can you not make a good match with those two? It's not physically possible to do anything bad with them. Even in 12 minutes, they produced a watchable piece of work that I really, really enjoyed. It wasn't their best stuff, but that was hampered by the fact they weren't the main event. And I'd argue that it really should have been the main event on a different card, because it's Riki Chosu and Tatsumi Fujinami defending the two most important titles in the company, and you didn't make an event around it? That's insane. But
it doesn't make any sense.
Antonio, Ninoki, what were you thinking? But this was really good. for those of you who don't know, we did go into detail about the Greatest 18 Championship on the last podcast, but we'll give you a rough recap here. The Greatest 18 Championship was originally the WWF Martial Arts World Heavyweight Championship, which was given to Antonio Inoki by Vince McMahon Sr. for his work in Japan. It was defended by him up until the point of them leaving the WWF, where it was renamed as the Greatest 18 Martial Arts World Championship, which he defeated Tiger Jeet Singh for in that street fight knockout brawl at Starrcade in the Tokyo Dome 1 that we covered last month. And he held the championship for a year, and then he defended it against In Fujinami in a unification match. And I really enjoyed this. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
This is really good.
Yeah.
It's interesting how, like, the pacing in this match isn't consistent. Sometimes it's really, really fast, and sometimes it's really, really slow. And you can only get a watchable match that has that when you have guys who are as good as both these guys are. You know? Like, they know what they're doing. They know that they're not meant to be putting on, like, a five-star classic, so they're both holding back a little bit. But they still know how to give you a really watchable match in, what was it, 12 minutes?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's fun. Like, it's just, it's not anything earth-shattering or groundbreaking, but it's fun. It's just, they're evenly matched, skill-wise, and that's nice. It's refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, they're barely ticking over at 12 minutes either, both of them. You know, these two need 20 minutes to get really going. You know, it's like that Hashimoto match earlier on the card, 8 minutes and 37 seconds with Kazmaier. Hashimoto hasn't got started. He's barely, like, warmed his limbs up at 8 minutes and 37 seconds. You know, his championship run was defined by matches that were 25 minutes long, and he barely did anything for the first 15 minutes except get hit. So,
yeah.
Sorry, Kim.
It made me think of how people who watch New Japan Pro for the very first time now oftentimes complain about the match length. Like, how are the matches so long? They're so long. It's like, well, the entire history of the company is that the guys who have the really big, meaningful matches have really long, intense, athletically challenging matches.
Yeah. Under normal circumstances, these two would be at it for at least half an hour. Probably 25 minutes. But in this particular case, there's nothing wrong with this match. It's great, but it should be twice as long, and it should be on a card by itself, because this is, like, a really important moment for New Japan Pro Wrestling, and I don't understand why it wasn't put somewhere else.
Probably WCW didn't want it somewhere else.
But equally, it's your company.
They probably got some of the things they wanted and not all of the things they wanted.
Yeah, I suppose so. But, you know, as well, I mean, me and you and Marcus, we talked about the Fujinami and Riki Chosu story a few months ago in the early episodes of this podcast. Where do you think they are at in this stage of their relationship?
It's kind of hard to tell. I don't know. It seems like... I can't tell if they're getting along personally, but they're both so committed to the work that they know. I mean, like, they just know the deal. Like, they're professionals, you know? Maybe I'm sort of getting the vibe that things weren't great between the two of them personally, but they had figured out how to work together anyway.
Yeah, I mean, at this particular point, Chiyosu's been back about 18 months from... we talked about this again in the earlier episodes, but we're linking back to it now. Chosu had left New Japan Pro Wrestling in 1984 to form his company and his bunch of outlaws, Ishingun, and then marauded off to All Japan Pro Wrestling, had their own company for a while, done a load of stuff, and then in 1988 he comes back. So I guess he's about 3 years in, actually, back to his New Japan return. So they've been milling around one another. And I guess it's like we said at the time, Fujinami was the company guy. He was loyal to Inoki through thick and thin, and Chosu had to go find his own path. It was a different story for him. But they're both comparable draws at this point, and they're both comparable wrestling quality at this point. Different ways of going about strong style, but certainly on a par when it came to actual wrestling ability. These guys were absolutely phenomenal.
And the crowd is really into it. Like, the crowd likes this match and likes those guys.
Which is what you want for your company ace and your counter ace, I think. That's what's got to happen. It's what Shinsuke Nakamura and Hiroshi Tanahashi did for 10 years. It's what Okada and Naito are doing now. Or Okada and Omega, I guess, really doing now. But it will be Okada and Naito. And we will be so happy when that happens. Well, Alex.
Yes,
well,
yes, please.
Alex Watt will certainly.
I'll be happy, man. I want to see Naito prove to everybody that they're wrong about him and that he's the greatest.
I want to see Okada put him in his place. But there you go. That's what the great.
We can still be friends, James.
Of course we can. Of course we can. Yeah, that doesn't mean we're mean to each other just because you're wrong. Right then, we'll go on to the main event. This is long before the days of LIJ and Chaos, so we're all right. We're in neutral territory here. We only had the Outlaws to worry about back then. All right then, match 12, which is the main event and was actually decided by fan vote, which was Sting and the Great Muta tagging together to wrestle the Steiner Brothers in 11 minutes and 3 seconds in a match which wasn't great but wasn't terrible, but had a disappointing ending. It was refereed by Bill Alfonso, Daddy, which was always makes me smile because Bill refereed every match for about 10 years before he went to ECW. He wrestled in, he refereed in WWE, WCW, Florida for years and years and years. And he was the kind of right guy to have in this match because you've got two American team and an American Japanese team. So he could control it better. He was very, very experienced. Going back to the story, he was talking about Luger. Bill Alfonso was the referee the night Lex Luger defended the Florida Championship against Bruiser Brody, and Bruiser was pissed off, and Bruiser actually got counted out in a cage match, and Lex Luger was trying to figure out what the hell to do all the time in this match because he didn't want Bruiser to kill him.
Yikes.
And Bill was the one that managed to get them through all of it. Bill has been there for many Lex Luger oh my god moments. But yeah, so Bill Alfonso the referee, because he was the official WCW referee at the time. But I thought Nick Patrick was a senior referee. I don't know why he never flew to any of the Japanese shows. That's really strange. But there you go. Anyway, match 12 was Sting and the Great Muta. This had been decided by fan votes, and Muta was really wrestling as a face, though he'd never really wrestled as an out-and-out face in Japan. He'd always kind of been a tweener, and obviously his character was developed in America, where he'd always been a heel. Now, the Steiners were so incredibly over in Japan at the time. You know, this was a period of time where the Steiners just could do no wrong in New Japan Pro Wrestling. They were absolutely beloved, to the point that when they signed with the WWF later in the year, they became the only tag team in history to have an outside deal with another company apart from the British Bulldogs. That's how much
wow.
The Steiners meant to Vince McMahon. They had a bit of a not that good run with the WWF. But they were on 10 grand a night, that was the rumor, each, for New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Jesus!
Yeah. And this was in 1992, you know, and they had a lot of big teams lined up to wrestle as well. They had Big Van Vader and Bam Bam Bigelow, the Jurassic Powers, Scott Norton and Hulk Hercules Hernandez, and the Hell Warriors who would come along, Road Warrior Hawk and Kensuke Sasaki as well. So this was, you know, big money for the Steiner Brothers in New Japan Pro Wrestling. They were a massive draw. So was Sting, as you'd imagine, who's WCW's biggest face star at the time, and so was the Great Muta. So it all kind of looked good on paper. Was it that good in real life, Chelsea?
This isn't like a five-star classic, but it is fun. Yeah. I was surprised that this is the most recommended match on this card on Cage Match, because that wasn't my impression of it. But it is fun to see the Steiners beating people up. That's just generally pretty entertaining. And I thought Muta was good here. Muta is one of those guys who, like, doesn't always hit for me. Like, sometimes I watch matches of his that are recommended, and I'm like, well, I couldn't really get into that. And I think what it is that for me, he just seems to lack that X factor. And what's interesting is that all the other guys in this match have it, you know? Like, I couldn't exactly tell you what it is about Sting that makes Sting good and interesting, but at this point, in this period at least, he had whatever that was. And the Steiners, I mean, like, come on, they were super, super charismatic. It felt kind of like the Island of Misfit Toys. It felt like, well, we had to put these guys in a thing, so we did. I mean, it was interesting that you said to me that the fans picked this match, because it didn't feel like a booker's decision. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It felt like somebody who doesn't normally book wrestling matches booked a wrestling match.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it boils down to, basically. And I mean, I enjoyed it. I love the Steiner period, Steiner brothers in this period. And it was saying last time that when they wrestled Hase and Sasaki, me and Alex kind of thought that though it was a legendary tag team match at the time, and it was argued by people like Lance Russell and even Jim Ross that it was the greatest tag match they'd ever seen, it doesn't hold up to the standards of even a couple of years later, where you have Doc and Gordy having these heartbreaking matches in WCW, you know, where they're really dominating people and telling incredible stories through dominance that they've learned to do in All Japan, and were having great matches in All Japan at the same time, consistently. I'm not saying that Steiners weren't having great matches. The Steiners were a great tag team, but they had to have the right guys to make great matches with. If you see what I mean. I think that's where I'm boiling down to, because I loved the Steiner brothers at the time. I thought they were absolutely incredible. You know, these were these big, big dudes who could wrestle. You didn't get big dudes who can wrestle. You had the Legion of Doom, you had the Skyscrapers, you had Doom, but they were powerhouse teams. They couldn't get on the mat and do mat wrestling and chain wrestling and throw suplexes like the Steiner brothers could. The Steiner brothers were just on another planet as far as that stuff was concerned. The only guys we ever saw got close to them at the time were Sasaki and Hase and Sasaki. So, yeah, I think you're right. It doesn't, because you've got two singles wrestlers who are tagging together for the first time, that's obviously going to cause issues. And whether they had chance to, you know, practice together because they work on different continents,
it doesn't really seem like they did.
No, and it's kind of surprising because they have great chemistry. If you go back to their world television title feud of 1989, those matches with Sting and Great Muta are absolutely stunning. They're really, really, really good, you know, because, and it's funny you said that you don't think he has the X factor. Muta in that time period was one of the most fascinating wrestlers I've ever seen. And because of that charisma he had. And I don't know whether it was the presentation, because he had Gary Hart with him and he came down to the ring and it was completely new and different. I hadn't seen anything like it, because I hadn't seen the great Kabuki, who he's obviously based upon, you know.
Right.
And you look at the way that character was developed. It was developed by the WCW booking crew of the time with Muta. So the people that developed it were guys like Jim Cornette and Jim Ross and Gary Hart, you know, the bookers. The great Southern bookers that there's ever been. You know, they knew how wrestling worked. And to me, I always have a fascination and a soft spot for that character, even though I do understand that Keiji Muta can be hit and miss sometimes. I do know understand what you're saying. But I always like the great Muta possibly more than Keiji Muto, because to me, that great Muta was such a cool character and something I was drawn to. And maybe it was the time I was exposed to it as well, because I hadn't watched wrestling in a long time because it not being on TV in the UK. On the first WCW show I ever saw, the main event was the great Muta defending the WCW World Television title against Ranger Ross. And he just clicked in my head as, that guy's awesome. But there you go.
You know, maybe if I watched a different match with him in it, I would get it. But this time I was just, to me, it seemed like he was missing something.
Maybe as well, because he's trying to be a face and it isn't his natural groove to be a face. He's a heel.
Yeah.
You know, and the mannerisms when you're trying to be a face or trying to be that, because it's a face-on-face matchup, that makes it difficult, which isn't necessarily a problem in Japan, because faces all the time in Japan. But because there's no tension there, they're getting angry for no reason. Like towards the end of the match, it all breaks down as people start brawling on the outside and stuff. And it's like, yeah, but you're really good mates in the story, in the universe of WCW, you're really good mates, and though you're really competitive, would you really start beating each other up outside the ring just because of a match? I don't think you would. So it kind of, as a WCW fan, going back to that mindset of 21-year-old James compared to 42-year-old James, it doesn't quite click, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, these things are deep-rooted. They take a while to get out of your head. If they've been done correctly, anyway. So, yeah, so that was a main event of a card that was clearly commercially popular. 54,000 people to 65,000 people paid to see it, we think. However, artistically, it's not necessarily best New Japan's best work, and isn't necessarily New Japan's best work of this time period, given the roster that they've got. Let's just go over this roster again. Black Cat, Jushin Thunder Liger, Super Strong Machine, Shiro Koshinaka, Masa Saito, Kim Duk, Tony Halm, Scott Norton, Shinya Hashimoto, Big Van Vader, Antonio Inoki, Hiroshi Hase, Masahiro Chono, Riki Chosu, Tatsuji Fujinami, and the Great Muta. And they managed to produce a card that was all right. Something's not quite clicking here yet, is it? But they're making money. That's the key thing.
Yeah. I mean, they're people definitely paid to be there and sit in those seats and watch this card.
Yeah. And I don't know if it was the drawing power WCW had. Maybe it is bigger than we thought it had, because certainly WCW was doing good numbers on the UK tours they were doing at the time. Within the next year, they'd tour the UK and Germany. That's where Mick Foley would lose his ear. So, you know, WCW were doing good business at this particular point, and they hadn't really reached their zenith as a creative power. Jim Herd was still in charge, which is obviously going to drag things down. You would have the Bill Hot Watts revolution within the next few months, and WCW would change forever, and it would cause a few knock-on other effects as well. You had Kip Allen Fry first, who was much more friendly to the wrestlers and was willing to open up purse strings to try and create moments with wrestlers by getting guys like Doc and Gordy in from All Japan. So despite the fact the roster of WCW was also quite strong with Sting, you still had, you know, you still had the Enforcers, you still had Sting, you had the Steiner Brothers, they had all these cool names. You had two companies that were kind of like creatively lost, but were still managing to make money despite the fact they were creatively lost.
Which is impressive.
Yeah. What can you do? Amazing, really, when you think about it. But there you go. So that was the card from New Japan Pro Wrestling called Supercard 2, or Starrcade in the Tokyo Dome to 1992. We hope you're enjoying the beginner's guide to Japanese wrestling. Though we're taking a break next week, because next week we are back on our review shows. There is two massive cards in America this weekend. Funnily enough, while the WWF are off in Japan. Interesting, that.
I wonder.
Yes. So next week we'll be looking at, well, possibly the last Impact Wrestling pay-per-view before they become Global Force Wrestling, Slammiversary 2017, which is on Sunday night, Monday night in the UK. So we'll be reviewing that. And also, it's the G1 Climax special from Los Angeles on tonight. In fact, as we're recording this on Saturday. So we'll be looking at that as well. So we've got a twofer pay-per-view coverage show next week. We hope you enjoyed the show today. I would like to thank my guest, Chelsea Spollen from ShouldersUp.net, where you can find her at Shoulders_up and at Chelsea Comics on Twitter.
Thanks for having me.
That's okay. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And we've got a lot more shows to record this summer.
Yay!
We'll let you know about that in a couple of weeks' time. But thank you very much for listening today. You can find me on Twitter at Sheriff Lone Star. You can listen to the other podcasts on the WrestleTalk Podcast Network, on Stitcher, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts from. Please do listen to The Squash. Ben and Gavin are doing a fantastic job. I think I might start calling him Brian from now on. Doing a fantastic job with The Squash over there. I hope you've enjoyed their shows recently. And of course, you can listen to Ollie Davis and Luke Owen and all the other guys on the YouTube channel free of charge. Thank you very much for listening to us today. Take care, and we'll see you soon. Bye.